And welcome to the Gifted Life Podcast, where we have conversations about organ, tissue, and eye donation and transplantation. You can always find us at thegiftedlife.org. I'm Marie Steele.
I'm Joey Boudreau.
And Nyla should be back soon, taking
Hopefully a little hiatus. Yes.
There you go. Coming up on this episode of The Gifted Life,
we'll be talking to a wife and mom who's using her tragedy to inspire change.
Yeah, a really moving story emphasizing why that yes to organ donation is oh so important. That and more right here on this episode of The Gifted Life. Thanks for listening. Hey, everybody, here on The Gifted Life Podcast, we are so excited to introduce you to our friend, Kelly McQueston. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you guys doing?
Good. We know that Kelly works with Lifeline of Ohio. She's a community outreach coordinator. And boy, does she have a story, huh?
She does.
She had us in tears, and we didn't even talk to her yet.
I know. I just was fortunate enough to meet Kelly on the phone just a minute ago. And to hear her and you, Laurie, both community outreach, both with a passion for spreading awareness and then finding out the rest of Kelly's story is pretty remarkable. Kelly, how are you today?
I'm doing okay. I just started back at work about 3 weeks ago. I was off for a while when my husband was first in the hospital, and then I took some extra time. So getting my feet wet again, I feel like a new employee again.
Yeah.
But I just trying every day to make the best of it and spread awareness.
And that's what we do here. We listen, we try to partner with folks from across the country, and we just learn. Our goal is to make life happen. I think we're on a similar step with that. And one of the first questions that I asked you was, when did your husband pass away? You said December 2023. So that just happened.
Yeah.
And so you're a couple of weeks past that. You're back at work now. Mm-hmm. But we saw this incredible story that you were able to do, and I know it was tough. You had us tearing up and thinking about life because he sounded pretty awesome. And we want to hear and learn about your hero. Let's start there.
Matt was just truly an amazing person. He was always positive and just wanting to make people laugh. He was a very goofy guy. He worked really hard for our family. He worked two jobs, one at a fire as a fire station and one as a paramedic for the Veterans Affairs here in Chillicothe, Ohio. Boy, did he love his kids. He worked so hard, and coming off a shift, he'd run straight to soccer practice and coach their teams. And we were always a family on the run, but we got to spend a lot of time together that way too. So very, very special man.
I feel like you're kind of like me. I'm always on my phone to video or to capture photos, right?
Oh,
I'm all about pictures. I lost a lot of family members, and I'm like, I love these pictures because they bring me back to that moment. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't understand that, but I was watching that video of the videos that you shared of him just like this hearty laugh and like loving on his kids, and the kids just laughing so much. Like,
oh, yeah.
That was so special to me to get to know him in that way.
Side note, I'm actually a photographer as like a part-time thing.
You did a great job.
Thank you. They are also used to having a camera in their face because of me, my boys. So they're pretty trained. They're trained pretty well, but Matt never really loved it, but he put up with it for me.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm glad I have those to look back on.
Yeah, those memories. But he looked like a strong, healthy man, but you guys found out that he had heart trouble. Walk us through that. I mean, you have young children at home and that getting that news and then that journey.
Yeah. So several years ago, he, firemen have to do like physicals for work. It's just part of their normal job. And they heard that he had a heart murmur on one of those, but we were told it was no big deal. This was when Grayson, our youngest, was a baby. So about 6 years ago or so. And they told him it was just something to watch out for. And honestly, we kind of didn't really think about it anymore because it didn't impact his life in any way. And then one morning he was getting ready for work early, like he always did. And I heard him walk over and it kind of woke me up. I thought he was saying goodbye to me for work for that day. And he told me my heart feels really weird. I'm going across the street to the hospital. And, you know, I was kind of in that days of just waking up, trying to process what he's saying. So right. I said, okay, do I need to come with you? And he told me no. And of course, like, I'm not going to listen to that. Right. So he leaves and goes across the street, and I'm already in, okay, I need to get the kids taken care of so I can get over there with them. So our oldest is 16, and I knew he could handle it. So I called my mom and let her know what was going on. And joined him over at the hospital, and he was in AFib with RVR. So they had him on a couple of drips to try to of medication to try to get him back into rhythm. I guess that's something that they can do, is try it with medication. But then they told us that they needed to do a cardioversion where they kind of shock his heart back into rhythm. And when they did that, they did a camera down his throat to view the heart. And after the procedure, it was really quick. They acted like it was no big deal. It was like a 20-minute thing. You know, the doctor came in to talk to us and told us, well, he has severe mitral valve regurgitation, and he's going to need surgery as soon as possible. So they actually referred us to Cleveland Clinic originally. And Matt was obviously, and I, we were both very shocked, but ready to get him better, because it's what we... You know, that was our main focus. He was mostly worried about not wanting to miss Thanksgiving and Christmas with the kids. That's what he was worried about. So he kept saying, can I push it till January? So, you know, we left with medications and the referral. And two days later, I woke up again early to the sound of him falling in the bathroom. And to be honest with you, he fell in such a loud way. I thought I was going to find him dead then. It was terrifying. But when I got to him, he was alert, but just kind of confused and said something's not right. So I obviously called the squad, and that's when we made it to OSU. He told them to take him there because he's like, you know, I'm not going to obviously be able to make it to Cleveland Clinic. No reason to go back to the same hospital when they referred me out. So we went there and started the process of figuring out what was going on. He actually was seen by a cardiologist in the emergency room, and she started screening him for a condition, and it seemed familiar to me. She was having him kind of like stretch his arms out and seeing if he was like hypermobile. She was having him tuck his thumbs in his fingers to see if he was, you know, super flexible. And I was like, you're screening him for Marfan syndrome. Mm-hmm. And she kind of whipped her head around at me, and she's like, how do you know what that is? And I was like, oh, well, my ex-husband, he has Loewy's seed syndrome. I said, I'm familiar with it. You know, the son that we share together, we had to have him screened for it as well. Luckily, my son Parker does not have Loewy's seed syndrome, but my ex-husband did. And I said, he got a heart transplant here 2 years ago. And she looked at me and she goes, I'm his doctor.
Oh.
I'm your ex-husband's doctor. So it was such a surreal moment for me, because I was like, what the heck? Like, I have an ex-husband who has this very rare connective tissue disorder. And then I see her screening, you know, my current husband that I've been with for 11 years for a similar condition. Mm. And I was just like, this can't be happening. It didn't even make sense to me that it could be happening, because it was just such a coincidence. And if I'm going to be honest with you, you know, I'm a person of faith. So for me, I was like, wow, all of these things happening, it's going to be okay, right? Because like, why would all of these weird coincidences be happening like this, where I have a doctor who cared for my ex-husband and helped him get a heart transplant, and now she's taking care of my current husband. Mm. So
take me through that a little bit. So, you know, you mentioned that the first episode he had AFib with RVR, which for the layman, essentially, that's when you have an irregular heartbeat that's really, really fast. Like, it trips into this really fast, irregular heartbeat, and it's hard to get out of it. So oftentimes, medicine is the first choice. If medicine doesn't work, then, as she mentioned, the cardiovert, so the the defibrillator piece, mm-hmm. you know, that, but it's on a certain setting, and they kind of shock it into, kind of stun it. And then a normal, SA node, your normal heartbeat picks up. And sometimes, unfortunately, that doesn't work and they have to do other things. And sometimes it does. Obviously it worked for a little bit. And then when he goes back in, when he has the next episode, he goes back in, they did, they looked, it did like a transesophageal echocardiogram. They did like a, an ultrasound, but like from the inside and mm-hmm. a look from the inside of everything and saw, you know, the mitral valve issues. You know, you have a couple valves in your heart and one of them was just not working right, mm-hmm. which unfortunately causes you everything to back up, because the reason it needs to work is it closes so that all your blood goes forward and none comes back.
Mm.
And when it does come back, obviously it causes really acute problems. And so, you know, and I know I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but I want to get back to the fact that you go from there. And that's one thing, because a lot of people have these things. Like mm-hmm. this is, my wife is a cardiac nurse practitioner, and I hear her talk about it all the time. But to get from that step to, you know, the testing for Marfan's to, like, when did you first think that he may need a transplant? Like, how did that kind of go about in your mind?
So when we were in the ER, you know, and she started screening him for Marfan's, and he scored for 6 out of 7 of the triggers, or whatever you would call it, for Marfan. So we still weren't really even sure. And we had the genetic appointment made for the day before his surgery, because, you know, those things take a little time to figure out if they have this rare condition. So it wasn't until he actually had his valve replacement surgery where things started to get really serious. So he went in for surgery, I think it was the 29th of November, if I'm remembering. I know dates aren't important, but he went in for that surgery. You know, he had chosen to go with a mechanical valve, but he really wanted the doctor to try to fix his valve first. So he was very stuck on that. And we were told it was going to be around a 6-hour surgery. And when we got to hour 8, me and his parents started to get really worried. And we asked for an update. And he had the chief of cardiothoracic surgery working on him. We were so trusting, like we knew that he was in the best hands.
Right.
And I still believe that to this day, that he was taken care of so well. But, you know, they pulled us into a private room for updates, and they had done that for other families, so we weren't too worried at that point. But when I saw the doctor come in and pull off his mask, I could read it all over his face, that something had gone wrong. And, you know, he had told us that, when he was repairing the valve, trying to repair it, that his heart just completely stopped working.
Mm.
And I found out later, they actually called it stone heart syndrome, I believe is what it's called, where globally the heart just stops working. And it's, again, it's kind of a rare thing. My husband was only 37 years old. So he was young, he was healthy. And, you know, the doctor even told us, after the complications, you know, he's young. We're going to give him time to rest and hope that he regains some function in his heart. But basically, when the heart stopped working, they tried to throw in the mechanical valve. It collapsed on itself. And then they did, you know, they're bypassing. They're trying to do different things to get his heart to work. And then they just had to go the ECMO route to help him out. And, that's when we got that update, is that he was going to be coming out on ECMO. So to answer your question, it wasn't until 2 days later that they told us that he was going to need a heart transplant. But because of my background and because of my ex-husband who got a heart transplant, it was one of the very first questions that I asked, is he going to need a heart transplant? The way that my mind works, I'm always kind of 5 steps ahead. And that kind of hated that about me, because he's always like, just, you know, live in the moment, don't worry. But I'm a worrier.
I worry,
what I do.
Yeah.
So I was already thinking, you know, 5 steps ahead, like, okay, and if his heart doesn't regain function, then what? It's kind of what I was, where I was going. And, you know, they did say, yes, he would need a heart transplant. So I was already thinking that. And to be honest with you, it gave me hope, which is such a weird thing to say. But because of the work that I do, that we all do, you know, we've seen the goodness that donation can do. We've seen lives saved. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, if this is what needs to happen, then his life can be saved because of that generous person who said yes to being a donor. And because my, you know, my ex-husband, he got a heart transplant and he, you know, he got it so quickly. He was very sick. I had hope then. I was like, donation's good. If we are in this terrible, devastating spot right now, at least we have donation to hold on to, right? He can get a heart transplant. And, you know, that kind of became the forefront of my mind. What do we need to do to get him on the list?
Wow. I'm just thinking, in addition to that, you've got boys at home. You have a job. And mm-hmm. I mean, this is a lot for you. But like you said, you're seasoned when it comes to this type of news. But how are you at that point dealing with all of that? You had a good support system?
I did. I had both of Matt's parents there. And my mom, she was at home with our three boys. She's such an angel. She watches 7 grandkids total. 3 of them are mine. And I knew that they were in good hands.
Yeah.
So, I instantly, like after I got the news, and obviously, you know, I'm devastated and we're all crying, and I look at my mother-in-law and say, I want my mom.
Yeah.
And she called her, and my mom was there so quick to be with us. And I, you know, it's like my mind went clinical, because before I worked at Lifeline, I worked at a hospital in a neurocritical care unit. And I worked there for 4 years, and I took care of very critically ill brain dead patients. You know, I had worked with patients who became donors. I worked with patients who have gotten better. But my mind went really clinical. And I know that sounds weird, because it was my husband, right? And it was devastating. But for the next 20 days that we were in the hospital after getting that really bad news, I was just like, what do I need to do to advocate for Matthew to get him better? And so I stayed what people would call really strong while in the hospital. I mean, obviously, I would have moments where I broke down because there were several setbacks. But I tried to be really strong for him in the hospital, because I don't want to say I was all he had, because he had all of his family there at different times, you know, with me and with him. But like, being his wife, being his next of kin in the hospital world, you know, making all of the decisions, I was all he had. So I went very clinical. I listened to rounds that the doctors did every day. I was asking questions. So it was like a blessing and a curse to have the knowledge that I have, because I knew what questions to ask, but I also knew what things meant. So I would go back to the lobby where I slept for the first 5 nights, because we weren't allowed to stay in the room because it's an ICU, so it's understandable. But I stayed in the lobby for the first 5 nights, and then eventually they got me an apartment right across the street, so I could be close. But I would go home at night after visiting hours, or, you know, to that apartment, and I would Google statistics. Mm. And it was so hard. Like, to go to unos.org and start looking up, okay, well, how many heart transplants were done at OSU last year? Like, having that knowledge and knowing to look for those things made it really hard. Sometimes the statistics aren't hopeful when you're looking at them. And my husband was very tall. He was 6'5". Mm. So that makes matching even harder, you know, because body size is important. And then when you throw in that he was O positive, it made it even harder, because that is, you know, they can only take O positive organs. So, or I don't know if he was O positive, but he was type O. So I don't know which one, actually. But I know that he could only take type O back. So they told us it's going to be like 5 times harder to match him because of his height and his blood type. So then I'm Googling statistics on type O, you know, transplants. And it was just, having too much knowledge was probably not good for me during that. And I kept a lot of it internal because I tried to be so strong when I was at the hospital to advocate for him.
I was going to say that's hard. That you always hear, don't Google, yeah. right? But then you right? you understand a lot of that. And then you're having to go in and face family members too. Like that's a tough place to, mm-hmm. to be. So you're doing all this. He's waiting, right? He's listed. Mm-hmm. All's okay with that.
Getting listed was a little bit of a battle. Like, I don't know how much you know about the listing process working in the OPO world, but for me, it took a lot longer than I anticipated. So in this moment, it was even a teaching moment for me for how much testing and things that people have to go through before they're listed. But, you know, he did get on the list. We were so happy that he did. We were hopeful. And then, you know, we waited, it was 14 days is how long we waited. And that was so hard for me to wrap my mind around. I know that, you know, there's nothing that we can do to get anybody a transplant sooner. We know that from working in donation. We educate people on that, you know, the listing process and how it works and how people are matched. But it was just so hard for me because I was looking up those statistics and because I know of all of the other organ procurement organizations around us, and I'm just going like, he has to get one. It doesn't make sense. And, you know, he was so critically ill, and I mentioned setbacks earlier. Anytime he would get blood products, it just felt like a punch in the gut because I knew the more blood products he got, the less likely he could match with someone, you know, because of those antibodies that he would get. So it was just every day, it was like I was hoping and praying that he could just hold on until the call came. His kidneys started to fail. So he, at one point, he had to get on dialysis as well. And it was like every time the doctors would come in, you know, they would tell me things and ask if I had any questions. My one question that I would always ask first is there anything that's going to get him off the list? Is anything happening that's going to get him off the list? Because that's what I was so scared about. Because, you know, they told me that if say his kidney did fail and he would need a kidney as well, that would start the listing process all over, which I didn't really know that from before. So it was just that daily up and down wave of trying to keep him stable enough to get a heart. And I'll tell you, every time they would call me, like at night, in the middle of the night, because he would have like a complication or something like that, my heart would just drop because yeah. I had my ringer on full blast because I'm thinking I'm going to get the call and it's going to yeah. be that he got a heart, yeah. right? So like that was hard for the phone to ring and it to never be that the heart was coming. And it got to the point where they told me Matt's going to need a total artificial heart placement to keep him strong enough as a bridge to transplantation. So that's where things really went downhill. We had to make the decision for that surgery to happen. And after, or I guess during that surgery, he suffered a stroke. And that's when he really started to not do well, and we knew that he was not going to be strong enough to get a heart or, you know, maintain life long enough to get the heart transplant. So it was 14 days that we waited and we didn't get one.
I'm really sorry to hear that outcome. You're so good at walking us through the emotions, what you were feeling, the information that you were getting. And then just as someone who works in the donation world and the fact that he didn't receive, where does that leave you in your heart and in your mind?
You know, at first I was really angry. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about stages of grief. You know, you hear that just in the world. And yeah, I was really angry at donation at first, which is hard because it was such a passion of mine for, you know, 8 years. And then there was a point where I had felt like I failed him, which Logically, I know that I didn't, but it felt that way for a little bit because this is my job. It's my job to inspire others to register and to say yes to save people. And it felt like I had failed him. Like, why didn't he get saved? But if anything, it's just showed me that I need to talk about it even more than I was before. And although it's heartbreaking to realize that I have my own story to share now when I go out and speak in the public, it's so important for me to talk about it because people need to understand how important it is to say yes to being a donor. Because if, you know, even just one more person would have said yes, there is a possibility that he could have still been here. So I just think it's important for people to understand that they're not just saving an individual, or, you know, up to 8 individuals is what we say when they say yes to being an organ donor. They're also saving their families.
Right.
Going through that,
I mean, Kelly, you got us tearing up on this.
I know. That's why I had to take a step back there for a second, because it's, you know, as you were talking about it, Lori and I, you know, prior to our conversation, I said, I was internalizing, and I said, I can imagine the frustration you probably felt, you know, because we're in this. Like, this is our mission. This is what we see every day. And it's like, well, this has to happen for me. And right? It not happening, extra frustration, grief, and anger is, you know, undoubtedly normal.
Yeah.
For people in our that do what we do. And we're in this together, you know, and I can assure you here, we're going to do everything we can to honor Matthew, and certainly
Thank
glad
you.
That you came on, because it's, you know, people need to know about Matthew. People need to know your story, and people need to say yes. You know, it's not just right for some people. It really is right for everyone. Like, it's saving a life, and even though it might not be someone they know. It's a Matthew, and it's you.
When I was just thinking between you, yourself and Matthew, and some of the clips that we saw, he had the hero's goodbye with the flag flying and firefighters and all that goes with it. And I was just thinking, there are people who now know about donation because of Matt and because of you sharing his story, his legacy.
Yeah.
And that's powerful for you and for your kids, right?
I was just completely overwhelmed by the amount of support we got from the fire department. I mean, we basically shut down our hometown with his funeral procession to the cemetery. They're some of the most amazing men and women I've met. And I will tell you, although, you know, the hospital journey was devastating and everything happening was so hard, I felt like I had an army behind me the whole time. And if you combine my friends and colleagues from Lifeline of Ohio and then the firemen, my goodness, I've never felt more supported. They have definitely shown up for me and my kids and for Matthew. And I know that his story will go on and will continue to go on because of all of the people that it's already touched.
Which includes us. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your thoughts. Thank you for letting us learn from you today. But final thoughts on our visit here today, Ms. Kelly?
I thank you guys for having me on to talk about our journey and Matt's story. Any chance that I have to talk about him, I will take, because he was my best friend and the love of my life. And he won't be forgotten. And like I said, if by sharing this journey that we went through together, if it helps even one family, then it was all worth it for me to come on and, you know, talk, even though I'm still grieving. And, you know, it's really hard to come back into this work, but knowing that it could help somebody is really important.
Yes. Kelly, you're a beautiful storyteller. I can feel the love you have for this man, for this hero, for your family, for your job, your coworkers. So we appreciate you taking the time to join us here. I think it's appropriate that we let people know that they can register anytime as an organ, eye, and tissue donor at registerme.org, that you have those conversations with your families, and that we save more lives. In our question and answer segment today, can I be a donor and still have an open casket funeral? We get that question a lot.
We do. I bet you do a lot in, yes, in the community. And I do as a clinician. You know, we get that even in the hospital, questions from the healthcare workers and things like that. And the answer is yes.
Yes.
You know, that it doesn't change the appearance in a funeral or in the casket in the funeral. And to the point where you probably, many people who ask the question, I'll let them know, like you probably have seen people in an open casket who were donors, whether it's eyes, tissues, or organ. So it happens.
And you would never know.
You would never know.
Yeah.
You know, so it happens often, and it does not impact in one way an open casket funeral.
Yeah. If you have a question for us here on the Gifted Life podcast, we ask that you give us a call. It's simple, 504-648-3477.
In every episode of The Gifted Life, we honor a hero. Today's hero is Jessica Wheat.
And we learn about Jessica from her family. My precious Jessica was only 2.5 years old when she relocated to heaven. She was energetic, funny, and observant. She had two favorites, her older sister Caitlin, 4 years old, and shoes. When she got shoes as a birthday gift, she refused to go to bed that night without wearing the new shoes. If she couldn't find the mate to a shoe, she simply substituted another one, unfazed that the two did not match. She especially liked wearing her sister's shoes. She learned to associate my putting on shoes with going somewhere. If I mentioned running an errand, Jessica would run to my room, grab my shoes, and put them on my feet for me. She also liked stickers, even stickers used to price items at a garage sale. Jessica was a beautiful little girl. How I miss her. Kay Wheat, Nana.
And now we pause and say thank you to Jessica for the gift of life.
That is going to do it for episode 237 of the Gifted Life podcast. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember to tell your friends. You can also register as an organ, tissue, and eye donor anytime. Remember that. It's registerme.org.
Yeah, and obviously, Laura, very special thanks to Kelly McQueston for coming on and sharing Matthew with us.
And incredible.
What a challenging time that she went through, and it was just like yesterday. And to be, you know, part of our family, you know, part of Lifeline of Ohio, and having basically your role there at Lifeline of Ohio for such a long time and the unfortunate time that she just went through, you know, but then turning that into now the fire that she's got. And she said now her mission is to have everyone say yes.
On the front lines.
Yeah,
on the front lines. Saving more lives.
So his story is going to be retold, and he's going to make a difference.
And I love that she had so much support, too, and that she joined us today. It's a tough time with the timing of everything, so we really appreciate her for visiting with us. Best place to find us, guys, is at our website, thegiftedlife.org. We hope that you share that with those you know.
Listen there and find links to listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Pandora, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating. It really helps others to find our podcast.
On social, please like our Facebook page. It's called The Gifted Life Podcast. We also hope that you follow us on Instagram at Gifted Life Pod. Our ask is that you go out and do things you wouldn't normally do to help us make life happen. Thanks so much. This is a production of the Louisiana Organ Procurement Agency, or LOPA. The Gifted Life is hosted by Lori Steele, Joey Boudreau, and Nyla Schwab. Producer is Shalon Caraway, and we are recorded, engineered, and mixed in our Covington, Louisiana studio by Troy Perez.